Good evening. This is Life Rattle, the story show. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight's show, Life Rattle number 1274, features two stories by new Life Rattle writer, Meera Jayarajan. Meera Jayarajan was born on the first day of spring in 1980 in Toronto, Ontario. The elder of two sisters, she was raised in the suburbs of Aurora by her parents, both of whom had emigrated from India in the early 1970s. After finishing high school, Meera knew exactly what direction she was headed in. She graduated from McMaster University with an honors degree in arts and science, and then went on to complete a doctorate of medicine from the University of Ottawa. Since graduating in 2010, Meera has been enjoying a fast-paced life, working in the emergency department at various hospitals in Toronto. She continuously seeks adventures and new stories and has extensively traveled the world, backpacking and volunteering abroad in shelters, hospitals, and orphanages. Meera spends much time with her family and friends and enjoys a good night out filled with dining, drinking, and dancing. She expresses herself through her singing, guitar playing, pottery classes, cooking, and of course her poetry and writing. With cool, precise prose, Meera brings us deep into a world that few of us experience firsthand. She brings us inside the white jacket of a medical practitioner. She doesn't tell us what it's like to bear the weight of responsibility for human lives. Her stories entrench you into the experience, both psychologically and physically. Tonight's first story details the grueling 12-hour shift of a resident, the ninth of 18 work days in a row, a test of endurance that seems impossible. Let's listen now as Meera Jayarajan reads her story, The Unit, tonight on Life Rattle.
The Unit by Meera Jayarajan. 5:45 a.m. The alarm shrieks. The second alarm chases the first. Loud, incessant beeping that pulls me from a restless sleep. I lie still on the bed. The sky is dark and the air cold when I leave the quiet of my house. My body moans in hungry protest. 6:15 a.m. I am in the intensive care unit, looking at the whiteboard in front of me. I scan the list of new admits, the chronics, and the in-betweeners. Some will require procedures today. Others will need nothing more than a quick glance. Some may eventually improve, leaving the hospital's ICU and an untimely death behind. And some will die. Others will be condemned to life support, feeding tubes, and the guilt-filled wishes of family members. I grip the black marker in my hand. It gets heavier with each name I tick off. My day endlessly stretches out before me. Today is day 9 of 18 straight days in the unit. 18 12-hour days that form a medicine-capped Mount Everest looming in front of me. 8 a.m. I have already seen and spoken to the nurses of all 5 of my intensive care patients. I have reviewed their vital signs, considered the results of their daily blood work, and gone through endless pages of medications. I have looked at their ventilation settings, trying to determine which patients are ready to breathe spontaneously, and which will remain on life support. That small, square machine with flashing lights and buttons that I don't understand is capable of supporting a human life while I rifle through paperwork. I have come up with a daily plan of action for each one of my patients. Seemingly simple plans. A slight increase in one man's potassium replacement and a larger decrease in another woman's fluid replacement. Without these changes, his heart's natural rhythm would begin to falter, skipping beats and engaging in longer pauses, and she would begin to drown in her own bodily fluids. 8:15 a.m. I gather with the other postgraduate medical residents for an hour of simulated resuscitation training. We take turns trying to bring a plastic mannequin back to life. We breathe oxygen into his lungs. We cannulate his plastic veins. We push life-saving drugs into his intravenous line, and we pump up and down on his chest. His ribs don't break, and his family doesn't cry out for us to save him. His skin remains cold and dry. Sometimes we save him, and sometimes we don't. Just like real life, I tell myself. But when we don't save him, I don't have to face a room full of people who love him. People who know his favorite piece of music, who share his most cherished memories, and who could recognize the sound of his voice anywhere. I don't have to tell them that their loved one has died, is deceased, is no more, has passed away, is gone. I don't have to see them, sometimes quietly, sometimes deafeningly, crumble in front of me as I falter with my hands. 10 a.m. I am starving. My stomach groans loudly and battles with the sounds of the ICU. Machines beep regularly, while the patients they monitor lie silent and motionless. Nurses, respiratory therapists, physiotherapists, and dietitians turn dials, change intravenous fluids, adjust blood pressure monitors, and trial different feeding formulas. Like an army of ants, they constantly scurry about to complete an infinite list of tasks. I tune out those maddening beeps and rings. I listen only for the blood-chilling tone of my code blue pager. The monotone sing-song of the dreaded cardiac arrest that will translate into a cascade of algorithmic events. Thankfully, it has yet to ring today. We round in a group, move like a congealed mass from patient to patient. At each bed, we stop and listen closely to the nurse's thorough head-to-toe report. We review piles of paperwork and scan x-rays. Then, all eyes are on the resident at hand, who delivers his or her carefully constructed plan of action for the day. While the rest of us shift our weight and try to stay focused, both the attending staff physician and the senior ICU fellow carefully dissect the plan. Together, they will delicately weigh the pros and cons of milliliters of fluid and micrograms of medication. In the end, what is left of the gutted plan will be undertaken, success and vindication, or discarded, yet another seemingly wasted morning effort. The minutes turn to hours, and my legs begin to throb in silent protest. 1:30 p.m. The rounding has come to an end, for now. I have 15 minutes to eat lunch before meeting with one of my patient's family members. As I walk quickly to the cafeteria, my pager rings. My heart stops for a second, and then beats on when I realize that the code blue pager has remained silent. I carry two pagers and a phone with me at all times. A musical, medical trio, so that I am readily available at a moment's notice. I pause in my tracks, faced with the classic resident dilemma. I can answer the page and risk having to go back to the unit, or I can continue to the ground floor cafeteria, where only 28 minutes officially remain in the lunch hour. Maybe it will be quick. I turn around and return the page. Lesson number one, when answering a page, it is never quick. The nurse tells me that one of my patients is dropping his blood pressure. He is febrile and likely has a bacterial infection, source unknown. I hurry back to examine him. I give him fluids, start him on another medication to maintain his pressure, listen to his heart and lungs. He is pale under the harsh lighting, and tubes exit from almost every orifice of his body. The breathing tube, delivering oxygen to his lungs, is taped tightly down to his gaping mouth. The nasogastric tube, feeding him protein-rich liquid, snakes deep into his left nostril, ending in his stomach. The arterial line, reading his blood pressure, sits in his right radial artery and produces an artistic waveform on the flashing monitor. The central venous catheter, delivering his fluids and medications, is sutured to the right side of his neck, a 15-centimeter tube swimming in his superior vena cava. A dialysis line that enables us to clear toxins from his blood is similarly fixed to the left side of his neck. A catheter exits from his bladder so that we can monitor what little urine he still produces, and a blood pressure cuff is secured to his right arm. So much plastic tubing, so little man left. His heart sounds are good, but I can barely hear any air entering his right lung. His hands and feet are warm to touch, but I struggle to find their pulses. I order a stat chest x-ray and see white markings instead of black ones where his right lung used to be, signs of a ravaging pneumonia. I start him on antibiotics, powerful ones, to cover the many bugs that could be feasting on his body. And I ask the nurse to page me again if he becomes unstable. The clock on my pager tells me that I am 5 minutes late for my family meeting. My stomach gathers strength, gives me one last angry kick, then becomes silent. I rush to our ICU family room to join the social worker who is preparing my patient's family. The purpose of this meeting is to inform a mother and her two teenage children that their husband and father is officially brain dead and has no hope of recovery. When I enter the room, three sets of eyes look up at me and my heart lurches. I am here to destroy their faith and to change their lives. I start by reiterating their loved one's condition and perilous journey in the ICU. I tell them that, despite our best efforts, the injury to his brain is beyond repair. I reassure them that he is not suffering in any way and encourage them to visit with him before we withdraw life support. I speak in calm, soothing tones and watch closely as all three of their hearts break. When the meeting is over, the social worker tells me that I have a special, gentle way with people and with death. I lock myself in the small, dingy hospital bathroom and cry. 4:30 p.m. I am almost finished examining and writing progress notes on my five patients. I scarf down a coffee and a chocolate chip cookie, both from the hospital cafe, and the energy stores are climbing. I have been working for 10 hours. When the last note is complete, I lean back into the cold, unyielding chair and breathe in deeply. I feel sick, exhausted, empty. Then the code blue pager shrieks. Code blue. Fifth floor. I leap off my chair, rush to the stairwell, sprint up to the fifth floor. I gasp, ragged breaths, as blood pumps loudly in my ears. I am the first physician to arrive at the code. The charge nurse has initiated CPR and is pumping up and down on the chest of an elderly woman. She is bouncing around like a rag doll while others grab a hold of her frail, pale limbs and desperately try to find intravenous access. Another nurse from the floor wheels in the crash cart and begins to hook the woman up to the monitors. Nurses and respiratory therapists hover around the patients. While wide-eyed medical and nursing students press against the wall in fear. I introduce myself as the team leader and ask for some history. 65 years old, with significant heart disease, found unresponsive and pulseless by one of the medical students. I attach her to the monitor, scan her heart's rhythm. Ventricular fibrillation. Her heart is struggling. Its chambers flail erratically, cannot fill, and fail to pump any blood forward. If we don't change this rhythm, she will die. The machine is charged. I'm clear. She's clear. Everyone is clear. Shock. Shock delivered. Her body jumps, and I shout at another nurse to resume CPR. I draw up some epinephrine and push it into her newly established IV. I wait 2 minutes before checking for a rhythm and a pulse. I have started to dream of patients dying. They arrest over and over again, and I cannot bring them back, despite all of my efforts. I recheck her pulse. Nothing. I recheck her rhythm. No change. We charge, shock, and give more medications. The CPR continues. Ribs break, sweat pours, and muscles ache. The air is tense, but the execution of steps smooth. Anesthesia is here to insert a breathing tube, and she vomits as it slides into her trachea. I glance at a card hanging above her bed. Taped to the wall, it reads, "Get well, Granny." A child's writing, written in bubblegum pink marker. Time of death, 5:15 p.m. I thank everyone in the room for their efforts and leave. Another resident, who has been caring for the patient, will update her family. I return to the ICU, where my team has just begun evening rounds. They look at me questioningly as I join them. I shake my head. Then we carry on. I round in a daze, trying to get the pink writing out of my mind. 6:30 p.m. The rounding has come to an end. I am not on call tonight. I am free to go home. I collect my heavy winter coat, gloves, an untouched bottle of water, and drag myself out of the ICU. I feel heavier than when I came in 12 hours ago. Stooped, I pull my feet across the colorless hospital floor, force myself into the elevator, and press the button for the 15th floor. I exit and walk by the familiar welcoming sign, the neonatal intensive care unit. The walls are the color of lilacs, and the air doesn't choke me. The mood is calm, so as not to disturb the tiny pink bodies. No flashing, screaming machines. No angry, disillusioned family members. No feelings of defeat, despair, death. The nurses, now used to my almost daily visits, smile warmly and usher me into a soft chair. I hold, cuddle, and feed the babies. They are warm in my arms, smell of hope and life. They will fight, heal, grow, and survive. I stay until my arms ache and my body is filled with a quiet sense of calm and peace. 8:30 p.m. I am home, alone in the quiet of my house. I make dinner, eat quickly. Then I flop down on the couch, switch on the television. I turn up the volume and watch the screen without any interest. 9:30 p.m. I collapse into bed, pray for sweet and calm dreams. 5:45 a.m. The alarm shrieks.
That was The Unit, written and read by Meera Jayarajan. Tonight's second story, brutal and provocative, invokes an overwhelming sense of powerlessness as a doctor faces a young patient with a very bleak future. Let's listen now as Meera Jayarajan reads her story, Rose.
Rose by Meera Jayarajan. The rumors spread quickly throughout the small hospital. The baby she is carrying belongs to her father. She came in early this morning and is waiting to see me. I enter the room, expecting to see a 22-year-old girl, fresh and youthful. My stomach turns as I sit down across from her. She smells like stale alcohol and dried vomit. I stare at her puffy face. Her eyes refuse to meet mine, and so we sit for a minute, in awkward silence. Then she lifts her head, pierces me with her hard, dark eyes. I have already read the contents of her thick chart. Depression, suicide attempts, drugs and alcohol. How only days before, a shoddy northern store rope had snapped under her weight. She is now under close hospital surveillance and is seeing me as part of a recommended therapy. Her expression is neutral, impossible to read. Her voice quivers when she speaks. An ugly purple bruise has formed on her thick neck, and her body shakes from pure exhaustion. "How can I help you?" I ask. She turns her arms for me to see. Pink slash marks cover her pale wrists, and track marks climb up her forearms. "Heroin," she whispers. She wants, craves, needs heroin. Now. I feel defeated. It will only be a matter of time before the rope will hold. I start with her past. Freud urges me on. It is the same story. One of six kids, raised by grandparents, while mom and dad roamed drunk around their small town. She didn't need to go to school. No one cared where she passed her time. So she spent it trying to avoid unprovoked outbursts of physical violence and verbal attacks. Any pools of love and support dried up very early on in her life, and her childhood balanced delicately on shards of self-preservation and survival. Alcohol was her first escape. At the age of 12, it provided her with the warmth she lacked and the numbness she now needs. It dulled her senses and her painful memories and made her feel giddy and fleetingly happy. The first time her father raped her, she didn't think she deserved it. Somehow, at the age of 15, despite life trying to beat it out of her, she managed to salvage what was left of her pride and dignity. She did the unthinkable. She told. In her close-knit community, where blood ran thick and, in fact, was shared by most, This was unacceptable. Her cries for help were silenced by brutal beatings, and any shred of innocence or identity was lost. The ravaging continued, but something did change. She now thought she deserved every cold touch and hard thrust. The first overdose came soon after and was the first in a long, unsuccessful line. I asked her what she wanted or hoped for each time she swallowed a handful of pills. She can only shrug. Maybe she doesn't know. Maybe it doesn't matter anymore. Her first child was born 3 years later. Following a sick, prophetic cycle, he was born to an alcoholic, psychologically devastated mother, and will be raised by grandparents who have survived into their 30s. Although she lived her entire life in a dry community, by age 19, she was a seasoned alcoholic, and at age 20, addicted to heroin. She is well known to the hospital community. Her name sends shivers down the spines of everyone who knows her story. Her very existence reflects the ongoing struggle of those who have failed to pull her out of such a hopeless, miserable world. But how do you break the grip of a lifetime of neglect, disappointment, and misery? How do you restore a young woman's childhood and her sense of self? How do you undo years of physical violence, sexual violence, and drug and alcohol abuse? She had found her answer. Death. This time, she won't be alone. The child she is carrying in her womb will go with her. She is certain that this child is her father's, and reached for the rope in utter despair. And here she is in my office, still alive, still pregnant, and in terrible withdrawal. She desperately wants to leave, desperately needs her next hit. She looks at me as if to say, "What would you do?" Only one thought comes to me: buy a stronger rope.
That was Rose, written and read by Mira Jayarajan. That concludes Life Rattle number 1274. My name is Lori Callis. Life Rattle was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Achtman. Tune in next week to hear more new stories.